Let me start by giving a few reminiscences here. As a young Foreign Service officer, relatively young, I was posted to Tashkent, Uzbekistan in 1993. This was just 2 years after Uzbekistan became an independent country. It was still very much a major outpost of the former Soviet Union, with an emphasis on Soviet. I was not a Sovietologist. My previous diplomatic assignments had been in South Asia, where the political heritage and the government heritage was the British Empire, was the Raj. In Tashkent, which totally fascinated me and which I loved, I knew there was something radically different from what I had been used to. My initial housing assignment, diplomatic housing assignment, was something a little bit unusual. It was a rather rustic cottage on the old KGB compound. This was the former KGB, they said at that time, but I quickly learned that KGB was not so very former at that time. I soon learned that I could not meet with any government officials unless the Uzbek side included a KGB minder, with just one exception. The chairman of the Union of Journalists, whom I learned later, reported up his chain, as they say, and regularly invited me to his apartment and challenged me to vodka toasts and bouts and see who can drink each other under the table. Let me just say that I won every time. I mention this because it points, in my view, to the fundamental difference between Central and South Asia to this day. South Asia's colonial heritage was the British Raj, as I mentioned, and it inherited, to one degree or another, the European heritage. Central Asia, by contrast, inherited the colonial heritage of the Soviet and Russian empires, going back, in many cases, several centuries. So why is this important? Why do I mention it? The European heritage, with its government structures and social contracts, flows from the Western Renaissance, Reformation, and Enlightenment, whereas the Russo-Soviet heritage flows in nearly a direct line from the Byzantine Empire. That explains, in part, why only three of the 15 former Soviet Socialist Republics, the three Baltic nations, have had a relatively easy and relatively successful transition. They had a European heritage because they didn't become captive nations, to use Cold War speak, until World War II. But Central Asia never had that. It had decades and decades of the Soviet and Russian imperial empires, and before that, it was mostly nomadic with some brilliant tribal khanates, with a special exception of the brilliant efflorescence of the Arab Renaissance, which fed the European Renaissance, and which was actually located not in Saudi Arabia, but in modern-day Uzbekistan. Let's focus down now on the five Central Asian states. Under the Soviet model, the economies of the five Central Asian republics were dictated by central planning resource needs of the broader Soviet Union, resulting in economic structures centered on single cash crops, like cotton, or exploitative industries. At the end of 1991 and onward, these newly independent governments had to fight a real uphill battle to develop diverse and dynamic economies, and they continue to do so to this day, and with varying degrees of success. Since my first diplomatic Central Asian tour in Uzbekistan, I've now spent many more years working in Central Asia, including, as you've heard, as ambassador to Tajikistan, chargé to Turkmenistan for a full year, and ambassador to Kazakhstan. So I've seen firsthand over 20 years how the states of Central Asia are still evolving and still striving to overcome their Soviet legacy. I'm gratified that the United States, from the beginning, sought to assist Central Asia as it developed. We were among the first countries in the world to recognize the independence of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Using the authorities of the 1992 Freedom Support Act, and Congress capitalized the word freedom because freedom was one of those brilliantly quirky congressional acronyms that stood for Freedom for Russia and Emerging Eurasian Democracies and Open Markets. Freedom. So is the Freedom Support Act. In any case, this dedicated considerable resources to support the former Soviet states as they transitioned over time from communism and central planning toward our ideals of democracy and free markets. And it wasn't only the Freedom Support Act. You know well about the incredibly important work of Nunn Lugar and many, many, many other programs in which significant, significant U.S. resources were dedicated to this region. I'll tell you honestly, many asked then and many still ask, why? Why should we expend resources in this area? Why should the United States care about the countries of Central Asia? And the most fundamental reply is really the geopolitical realpolitik reply. Look at the map. Central Asia shares borders with Afghanistan, China, Russia, and Iran. This is an interesting neighborhood, to say the least. If nothing else, geography makes Central Asia critically important for the United States. But besides that, the region has much to offer. Let's consider some facts. Central Asia is comprised of secular governments with majority Muslim populations. While the region's governments still struggle to find a balance between secular state politics and religious freedom, its Muslim majority and religious minority groups have lived together peacefully for centuries. If nothing else, let's not forget the ancient Bukharan Jewish community of modern-day Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. Further, this region is awash in natural resources. Turkmenistan has the fourth largest natural gas reserves in the world. Kazakhstan has the second largest oil reserves of the former Soviet Union, second only to Russia. Uzbekistan is a major producer of uranium, as is Kazakhstan, and has large natural gas reserves, as does, quite likely, Tajikistan. And Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan have significant hydropower potential. But this is not why we are in Central Asia, as some people will assert. It's to get the energy. No, there's more. The economies of Central Asia are more than the sum of their energy-generating potential. Kazakhstan pursued fundamental economic reform from the very beginning of its independence and has now created a financial services hub for the whole region that links it economically to the rest of the world. Uzbekistan's educated population of 30 million has a huge potential to provide entrepreneurial, innovative economic growth. But I have to emphasize potential at that point. Kyrgyzstan implemented democratic structures from the very beginning of its independence and to this day remains the test case for democracy in this region. And Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan's incredible natural beauty could attract throngs of trekkers and others from Boise to Beijing, powering a thriving tourism sector, as could, of course, Uzbekistan's great Silk Road cities of Samarkand, Bukhara, and Khiva. So the United States clearly has an enduring interest in strong bilateral relations with each of the five Central Asian states. While these five countries were certainly helpful in supporting our Afghanistan efforts, our relationships with them are much more dynamic and go beyond a single yet important issue like Afghanistan. And yet the Central Asians are now uneasy as we transition in Afghanistan. And they have been asking, are you going to cut and run? For over a year, we've been saying, no, we assure you, we're not going to cut and run. And if you want objective evidence, simply look at the fact that we have built or are now building major new state-of-the-art embassies in every capital of Central Asia. Why would we expend this kind of taxpayers' money if we weren't serious about long-term relationships? I want to emphasize, the United States' diplomatic presence in Central Asia is not temporary. It's enduring long into the future. Broadly speaking, we have four critical areas of cooperation and concentration in Central Asia: security cooperation, economic ties, promotion of human rights and good governance, and efforts to bolster each country's sovereignty and independence. While our policy goals can be grouped into these four broad categories, the way we implement our policies in each country varies according to the country, of course. And this is certainly not a monolithic region. It's a dynamic and diverse group of states with independent and diverse national interests, and we adjust our approach according to the specific conditions in each country. And if we want to enable Central Asia to reach its full potential, if we want to help connect Central Asia to lucrative external markets in Europe and Asia, if we want to improve governance and rule of law in the region, we must remain engaged. And we will. Over time, we've learned to take each country as it is. The days of talking about the stands is long past, and that's really a faux pas now, thank God. We recognize that the countries of Central Asia differentiated their own paths, and to be blunt, they jostle against each other. The interests of one sometimes conflicts with the interests of another. For example, upstream and downstream countries are still working to sort out water rights. Borders were ill-defined, especially with that unusual system of enclaves and exclaves in the sensitive Fergana Valley that the Soviets carved up in a classic divide and conquer cartographic and ethnographic exercise in the 1920s and 1930s. Supply chains for essentials like food and electricity were suddenly split and separated among separate sovereign entities. Partly as a result of this history of conflicting national interests, Central Asia is now one of the least economically integrated regions in the world. But with the right engagement from its partners and neighbors, it can potentially transform itself into a model of connectivity. Already, interregional trade is beginning to increase, albeit from a very low base, and the cost of moving goods across borders is beginning to decrease. And this is not just within Central Asia. Trade with China, Turkey, and other neighbors is on the rise. Central Asia's immediate neighbors see the potential, and they are also focusing their efforts on greater regional connectivity. Let's start with Afghanistan, where we've spent a tremendous amount of blood and treasure over the past 13 years. With the reduced U.S. combat presence and Afghan National Security Forces taking the lead, Afghanistan's stability will increasingly depend on its ability to sustain itself, not just in the security sphere, but also in the economic sphere. While the international community will continue its strong support for Afghanistan in the near future, eventually and inevitably, Afghanistan will have to stand on its own two feet. But that will only be possible if Afghanistan can connect its economy to the countries of Central and South Asia, to China and to Europe, serving as a hub for regional energy markets and with reliable trade and transport links benefiting the entire region. The United States is doing its part to help build those markets and links, especially with our new Silk Road initiative, which focuses on improving north-south energy markets, trade and transport infrastructure, customs and border procedures, and people-to-people business networks. Through our efforts, we're increasing efficiency, growing the economic pie, opening borders to trade, and we hope closing them to crime, and spurring innovation and understanding. And Afghanistan is also embracing the vision of Asian connectivity. Just last week, President Ghani addressed the joint session of Congress and said, and I quote, "We are engaging our neighbors across Asia to build trust in trade. Afghanistan will become a platform for cooperation in a vast region that extends from India to Azerbaijan and beyond." He then followed on by speaking about the Lapis-Lazuli corridor, which would run through Afghanistan and Turkmenistan across the Caspian to Georgia and on to Turkey and into Europe. China, another important neighbor, has plans to advance Asian connectivity with overland and maritime routes. China has already committed tens of billions of dollars to building roads and railroads to better connect its factories to markets in Asia and Europe. For example, by using new overland routes or reconditioned overland routes, one part of China's ambitious Silk Road economic belt will reportedly cut commercial overland transit times from Western China to Germany and beyond to 14 days, whereas right now it takes 44 days by sea. China is investing heavily in Central Asian transport infrastructures. Once built, these new highway and railroad connections will also open up new opportunities for U.S. and other international businesses to better access Asian markets, including those in Central Asia. China's development of energy, road, and transport infrastructure to Central Asia can be consistent with and fully complementary to U.S. efforts. We certainly do not see China's involvement in Central Asia in any zero-sum term. We're consulting with China and looking at where we can collaborate in our efforts. In fact, this coming May, I'll lead a U.S. government team to Beijing for in-depth consultations on how we might collaborate to benefit all of our national interests, first and foremost, the national interests of the Central Asian states and Afghanistan. And because international companies are more likely to invest when they can compete on a level playing field, we need to ensure that the emerging regulatory architecture in the region meets international standards. To promote that level playing field, we're cooperating with the governments of Central Asia to help create institutions that meet those international standards. We provide technical assistance to our Central Asian partners to promote open but secure borders and reduce regulatory barriers to trade. However, as a cautionary footnote, let me add that level playing fields and adherence to international standards actually will depend on political will at the top. And in some, but not all, Central Asian states, I have to admit that's still a bit of a work in progress. Central Asia's geography also places it in close proximity to Iran, a country that shares many ancient cultural and economic ties with Central Asia. We are aware that there are areas on which Iran's Central Asian neighbors need cooperation with Tehran, including water conservation, desertification, countering the trade of illicit narcotics, and much more. So we hope that Iran finds a productive way to work with its Central Asian neighbors. Turning north now, Russia remains an important, essential trade partner for the countries of Central Asia, which also share close historical, cultural, and linguistic ties with their neighbor. Remittances are a clear indication of how large Russia's economic role is. Money sent home by migrant laborers working in Russia comprised last year about 50% of Tajikistan's GDP and close to 30% of Kyrgyzstan's. Even with the recent decline in the Russian ruble's value, the economic ties that bind Russia and Central Asia remain complex and strong. And even though the European Union is now the top consumer of Kazakhstan's oil and gas exports, trade with Russia is still critical for Kazakhstan's economic well-being. Kazakhstan is also a key member of the new Eurasian Economic Union of Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, with Kyrgyzstan and Armenia to join during this year. In our view, the Eurasian Economic Union should be a trade liberalizing rather than a trade restricting organization, should not become overly politicized, and should not impose conditions or restrictions on its members' ties with other countries. So we encourage the Eurasian Economic Union to follow the successful open model of Europe and not establish new trade barriers, which would impede regional economic growth. And of course, it goes without saying that Russia's occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea and aggression in eastern Ukraine is a serious cause for concern in the capitals of Central Asia. So with such prominent and powerful neighbors, China, Russia, and Iran, the Central Asian states remain interested in maintaining a strong bilateral relationship with the United States as they employ, in differing ways, what many of them call multi-vector foreign policies, with the goal of gaining maximum benefit while preserving their sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. For all the reasons I've so far outlined, we believe that close ties with the countries of Central Asia are clearly in our U.S. national interest. And yet, conferences like this one notwithstanding, the states of Central Asia don't receive much attention in Washington, D.C. For one, they lack powerful diaspora groups that can advocate to Congress. And most policymakers are focused on hotspots around the globe. Central Asia is not in this hotspot category, and thank God for that. The exception is human rights, which people in Washington indeed do pay attention to. We are consistently engaged in the countries of Central Asia to improve their track records on human rights, with the clear recognition that effecting change in this area will be difficult and will definitely require long-term engagement. Progress takes place slowly, and we must convince each government that reforms are in its national interests. Furthermore, those issues are core to our policy because they are fundamentals of our worldview. They are Western values. They are our values. But let me be both humble and frank. Our own human rights record, U.S. human rights record, is now nearly 240 years in the making, and it's still very much a work in progress. But there is no doubt that our commitment to improving human rights in our country has made us a stronger and more resilient nation. So while we share many common interests with the countries of Central Asia, like increasing commerce and supporting stability in Afghanistan, we don't shy away from the issues that remain a challenge, like human rights and religious freedom. If I may, I'd like to add a personal as well as a professional view here, based on long years of experience. And that is this: public naming and shaming, as well as threats of sanctions, have little, if any, effect in Central Asia. What tends to work better is to build relationships with like-minded senior officials in those countries, and they do exist, I assure you, the like-minded, who can then advocate their own views to their leadership. This kind of patient, traditional, reality-based diplomacy does, consistently on a case-by-case basis, work in Central Asia. Over the years, we have strongly supported assistance programming to improve governance and human rights in Central Asia. We've supported human rights organizations, rule of law reforms, civil society, and the mass media, including now increasingly social media. Through a variety of long-running and well-established educational and cultural exchange programs, we're also directly supporting the people of Central Asia. Once again, let me add an important personal footnote here. This kind of soft diplomacy does not have as its goal color revolutions. As Moscow nefariously whispers in Central Asian ears with its onslaught of black propaganda. What we simply do is stand with the people of Central Asia who want nothing better than better lives for their children and grandchildren, as do people all over the world. Our programs aren't about making us feel good. They're about expanding understanding of our policies, our values, our principles, which are congruent, going back to what I started with the Western Renaissance, and which are congruent with the Arab Renaissance, both of which we believe are totally relevant and wholly humane. Our public diplomacy is about creating personal relationships with people, no matter where they might be, who want to make things better, who want to create a better, more humane world. Here's an interesting factoid. Over the past 23 years, well over 24,000 citizens of Central Asia have come to the United States on State Department-funded exchange programs. They've gone on to become high-ranking government officials, effective community leaders, leaders of civil society, and successful business pioneers. We're very pleased for them. We're investing in people to drive the region's growth and evolution because we know how important this region is to our own interests. I'm pleased to tell you we have a cadre of talented, veteran U.S. ambassadors with decades of Central Asian experience now serving in the region or about to be deployed this summer. So, we will continue to engage with Central Asia to advance our interests there. We will continue to invest our resources in the region's security and its economic, political, and social development. And we will continue to forge long-term relationships based on mutual interests and mutual respect. We've been with the countries of Central Asia from the beginning, and we will still be with them in the years and decades to come. So, I thank you for your patience, thank you for listening, and I really look forward to a few questions and answers here. Angela?
Thank you very much. Would you like to remain standing?
Yeah, sure.
Or would you like to sit down?
Okay. I'm fine.
I'm going to maybe ask you the first question, if that's okay. So one of the issues that we discussed in previous panels is the question of leadership transition. President Karimov, of course, has just been reelected. President Nazarbayev will be reelected next month, and yet...
You think so?
I think so.
All right.
I'm really sticking my neck out by making this prediction. But we know that, you know, over the next however many years, the question of leadership succession will come up. How concerned are you about this as a source of instability in the region?
Well, thank you for that good question, because this is a question that is asked all the time at many different levels in many different fora. I'm going to please go off the record here and tell you, give you an answer based on my experience. I think that there is at least one country in Central Asia, Eurasia, that has put in enough structures and traditions to have a fairly smooth government-mandated transition, and that, frankly, would be Kazakhstan. For others, I think we have at least one example that we could look to. There might be smooth transitions based on at least the formal written constitutions. But the example I would point to is Turkmenistan, when President Niyazov died unexpectedly. What happened when he was the ultimate autocrat of the region? People met throughout the night, security leaders, government leaders, tribal leaders, business leaders, and tried to find what would be the one leader who would not upset the apple cart. And I sort of think that that might happen in other countries too, where the structures aren't in place. to support a constitutional smooth transition. But that's just my personal view.
Thank you. We have time for some questions. Would you like to field your own questions?
Why don't you do it for
me? Okay. All right.
If you
we'll
will.
Start off with the lady.
Thank you so much. I'm Nalbahori Mamova from the Voice of America. I'm not going to ask you about the outcome of yesterday's presidential elections in Uzbekistan because I'm sure your press statement was written a week ago or longer. Well, you're more than welcome to give it to us because, I mean, obviously nobody is surprised that he won. However, it does raise an interesting question. In your years of experience in the region, have you ever been surprised? And if no, when and where you think we'll be surprised?
Ever been surprised by an election?
Yeah, in the region, in Central Asia. I mean, you have pretty much worked in every country.
You know, when we were talking about transitions, I have to apologize. I'll get to that. But this is what leads into it. I have to apologize because I didn't mention Kyrgyzstan, where there were sort of regular every 5 year revolutions, but yet there were democratic transitions. So that is another model that can pertain. Have we ever been really surprised by any outcome? I can't think of one, honestly. I think one that we should be watching really carefully, and let me say this again, it's a personal view, is Kazakhstan. This election is coming several years early. The president there, President Nazarbayev, had been saying in public for several years that it might be time to begin to think about the future. And I think that that's still going on there. Just because there's an election coming up next month doesn't mean that it's settled for, you know, years and years and years into the future. And again, I think there are possibly enough government traditions in place there to make a relatively smooth transition.
Okay. Jean Rumer?
Jean?
Can we have a mic, please? Can you wait for the mic?
I'll shout
for... No, here comes the mic.
Ambassador Hoagland, thank you very much for a very thoughtful and comprehensive overview. And perhaps the question I'm about to ask, you might want to answer it off the record as well. Oftentimes in our engagement with Central Asia, the State Department has been quite forward-leading, as well as the executive branch overall. But a lot of criticism and a lot of opposition has come from the Hill. Mm-hmm. Do you sense that there is a new, perhaps more nuanced approach to Central Asia these days on the Hill, or do you think it's still an uphill struggle to convince congressional critics of Central Asia's region as a whole, human rights and other policies, that it's an important region? Thank you.
Well, you know, I think that's inevitable between our branches of government because the focus is different in each. And as I mentioned briefly in these comments, there's just not a large enough diaspora or, frankly, business interests here in the United States to advocate strongly to Central Asia. What we see, though, is the great value of congressional staffers, Hill staffers, taking staff delegations throughout the region, and members of Congress taking congressional delegations. It doesn't mean that it's going to change their minds overnight. Everyone is going to maintain a certain perspective, but nothing beats getting people on the ground to talk with citizens, to go to the markets, to talk with members of parliament, and that's valuable. We've got a staff del that with a few pretty hard critics of this region scheduled to go out in the coming months, and I welcome that. When I was ambassador in several countries, I always made it clear to my colleagues on the Hill, you are most welcome, please come.
Other questions?
Yeah. Thank you, Ambassador Hoagland. Jeff Goldstein from the Open Society Foundations. I'm looking at the report last year from the Director of National Intelligence on threats to U.S. interests worldwide. There's a small section on Central Asia. And it says that Central Asian militants fighting in Afghanistan and Pakistan will likely continue to pose a threat, but sources of potential internal instability in Central Asia will probably remain more acute than external threats. Unclear political succession plans, endemic corruption, weak economies, ethnic tensions, and political repression are long-term sources of instability in Central Asia. Now, since instability in Central Asia is clearly contrary to all the U.S. interests you laid out, can you tell us with some specificity what the U.S. is doing to try and address some of these threat factors?
Well, look, I appreciate the genesis of that question. We have discussed this over the years, and I have high respect for it. I think what we're doing is that long-term investment thing, which I outlined to a degree here. 24,000 citizens of Central Asia who have been on various kinds of exchange programs in the United States. A number who have gone back to become community leaders, regional leaders, even national leaders. And I assure you, in my own conversations with those leaders at the national level, we do find those, as I said, who are like-minded and share the more global values. I think that by working with them very carefully, empowering but not overshadowing them, encouraging them to advocate to their own leadership, then we do see that. I personally am not totally convinced that the kinds of repression that some people see from the outside is going to lead to revolutions in these countries. Because I'll tell you frankly, living in those countries, and Ambassador Ordway, I think, would also agree with this, a very large percentage of the population are not, frankly, overly concerned about that. It's been their way of life. They've learned to live with it. And even some of the civil society groups that bought into soon after, well, actually before the fall of the Soviet Union, before the Rasputin, the Refuseniks, all the others, they have maintained a real base of commonality and interest in their country, but we haven't seen it expand very dramatically. So that's why I would argue for long-term engagement, slowly building up, and patient engagement. The one thing that could become a game changer in the next decade is social media. You know, we're beginning to see how that plays a role. So let's watch that really closely.
Any other questions? We'll give you another one while people are thinking.
So going back to the outcome of the presidential elections, if, let's say, President Karimov sought your advice, would you have advised him to run again? I mean, now OSCE is saying that he shouldn't have run because, I mean, OSCE, which U.S. plays a huge role in, is concluding that he shouldn't have run because Constitution says two terms only.
Yeah, I know what the Constitution says. Let me tell you that a good diplomat, even off the record, never answers a theoretical question like that. What we might have said or might not have said to the president would certainly remain in diplomatic channels. So let me leave it at that. But you sort of get my drift. Okay?
Thank you for your presentation, Ambassador Hoglund. I am Umed Babakhanov, Asia Plus News Agency from Tajikistan.
Yes.
Nice to see you.
I know Asia Plus very well.
Yeah, thank you. Ambassador, you mentioned difference in mentalities in South Asian countries and in Central Asian countries. In one case, it's colonial legacy and Soviet legacy in mm-hmm. the case of Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But still in Afghanistan, as I assume that 14 years ago when the United States began its operation and struggle with terrorism, the perception of the USA was not so friendly. Now, 14 years later, I think it's changed. And perception of the US much more positive.
In Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan, okay, yes. In Afghanistan. At least, I think, at least in younger generation who got American education, who worked in American structure, and so on and so on. Do you think this is because of amount of investments to Afghanistan? If yes, do you think that increase of investment to Central Asian countries would also could change the mentality and perception of the United States?
You know what? That's a really good question. First of all, it's important to recognize that the people of Afghanistan, the Afghan people, no matter their ethnic group, have always been radically independent and have protected their own independence. We saw in the 19th century during the Great Game when the British Raj and the Russian Empire were butting up against each other in Afghanistan. During the Cold War, we had this sort of the same kind of standoff in South Asia with the various client states, India, Soviet Union, others, the United States. You mentioned the investment. Yes, a huge amount of money has been poured into Afghanistan over the past 13, 14 years or so. I personally think maybe that plays a role, but I think it's a minor role. I think more is the exposure to international ways of thinking and international education, not just U.S. education. I can give you another example of where that has paid off, too. And that is in Kazakhstan. I mentioned in the comments that Kazakhstan very early on did macroeconomic reform that has paid off over the time. Something else they did from the very beginning was focus on international education, because the president at independence said we cannot have a new independent country unless we have a citizenry with new independent ways of thinking. And even before the oil money started to pour in, they dedicated a good amount of money for full four-year college education for citizens of Kazakhstan, not just in the United States, but in Europe, in Singapore, and elsewhere. But what that has done is create a generation of globalized young Kazakhstanis. I think that's happening in Afghanistan, and I hope that it'll happen in other places, too, because it's to everyone's benefit, first and foremost to the people of those countries.
People are thinking, maybe I'll ask you a question that sort of ties into that. One of the other issues we discussed earlier on in the day is the continuing appeal of Russian soft power in the region, particularly the people, the elites and others in the different Central Asian countries who watch Russian television and whose understanding of the world and the, you know, the role of the United States and who's guilty of what is very much derived from that. Obviously, this is a very powerful, still a powerful tool, if you like, for the Russians. What are we doing in this region to try and present other narratives about what's happening in the world?
Oh, Angela, that's a good question. It's something I focused on in much of my career. Yes, indeed, Russian so-called soft power blankets the region because people in the region love watching on TV what they're used to, and what they're used to is Russian TV. As the Russian media space for multiple viewpoints has radically decreased in the last couple of years, they are in Central Asia getting blanketed by this anti-American narrative. I wish I could say that we're doing more. I wish there were, let's say a Russian language CNN or something, or PBS or something like that, but there isn't. And so we are working again, with various kinds of programming, working with journalists, helping them find independent sources of information. But shouldn't even say this, but I think we're still being outflanked a little bit, at least in the periphery.
Well, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much for this very educational
speech. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.